ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's it really like to go to space?
What can you see out of the windows of the space shuttle?
Would you fly to space on a shuttle?
Is flying with SpaceX safer than flying with NASA?
And how do we contact Orion when it's on the far side of the moon?
Welcome to a special bonus episode of Science Friction, The Challenger Legacy from ABC Radio National. I'm Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl, and it's time to answer some of your questions.
Yes, now Carl, we have been inundated with questions straight into the Science Friction inbox, which is wonderful, from people who have loved and listened to the series.
And it makes me think of that old saying, it's not the answer that gets you the Nobel Prize, it's the question. And so some of the questions really forced me to go deep and do some homework on stuff that I superficially thought that I knew, but in fact I did not. So thank you, beloved audience, for giving me some extra homework.
Let's get stuck in. Now, the first is a question from Helen from Baldwin. She says, hi, Dr. Carl. You told us about your NASA astronaut application. If you had been chosen to be an astronaut on Challenger in 1986, would you have boarded the space shuttle if the engineers had explained to you their concerns about the sub-zero launch temperature?
If I just knew what an outsider knew, I definitely would have gone ahead. If, however, I knew that the engineers had seen problems with the second launch, the problems being the gas getting past one of the two O-rings, and even if I'd been told, I still would have gone, and even if they told me all of that we'd been getting the gas coming through, I would have gone with that wonderful phrase, which I'll ask you to explain to the audience, and I would have just gone ahead with it, because I had been subject to normalisation of deviance. Please explain, Dr. Fiona.
Normalisation of deviance, which of course we've learned about in this series, is the gradual erosion of safety protocols when we're operating slightly off kilter, but nothing terrible has happened yet. So you'd go ahead.
With the knowledge that I had, which includes the fact that not one of them had blown up, except for the one I was about to go on, I would have said yes.
Wow, there you go. Now, we have another one. This is more along the lines of funding. Hi, Fiona and Dr. Carl. Jamie from Tasmania here. My partner Fran and I really loved your Challenger Legacy series. Thank you very much. Poor Bob at the end brought a tear to both our eye. I've seen people say the shuttle program was overall so expensive that NASA would have saved money if they just kept flying Saturn V rockets, which was the Apollo rocket, and dumping them in the ocean. Is that true? Did the shuttle have other advantages over the disposable rocket approach? What do people in the space industry think about it now?
Okay, look, you start, Fiona, and I'll try and fill in the gaps.
Okay. So, you know, there's no question the shuttle program over its lifetime was very, very expensive. The estimates kind of vary. The cost of each launch was at least $450 million. And as much as $1.5 billion. So it was expensive. But the fact that it was reusable was, you know, nothing to sniff at.
And it could do things that the Saturn could not. It could really fly in space as opposed to the capsules that are launched on top of the SpaceX. And so they were able to go into space and go nowhere near the International Space Station and go to a much higher orbit all by themselves and do repairs on the Hubble. Mm. And so the space shuttle was unique in that it could do it. Also, it could launch large payloads repeatedly to the low Earth orbit. And in fact, thanks to the space shuttle, we've had humans living in space continuously for, what, over a quarter of a century. The shuttle did not achieve the low cost per flight that it was promised because of it was just much more complicated, so it did not meet its ambitious goals. But on the other hand, it had other advantages. It gave us reusable access to orbit, taught us how to do servicing, helped us put stuff in orbit. It was a bridge model. It was the number one that let us go to number two, and almost certainly there'll be another number three. Cost wasn't dramatically cheaper, no, unfortunately. Bummer.
Interestingly, in terms of reusability of, say, the Artemis space launch system, basically every aspect of that is not being reused. I spoke to Peter King. He's the correspondent for CBS News Radio, and he talked about the implications of that economically.
The space launch system is a behemoth. It's an amazing sight, but it is crazy expensive. And unlike the SpaceX rockets, unlike Blue Origin's rockets, none of it is reusable. It's like $4 billion per launch, one and done. Imagine if you were flying a Boeing 777 or 787 and you threw it away after every flight. That's pretty much what happens here. So I don't know how long the SLS will last.
Now, this one comes from Sergey in Canberra. Hi, Fiona and Carl. Thanks for this fascinating series. Me having worked in an aviation safety organisation. Oh, I love aeroplanes, they're so safe. Would you say that NASA is still well ahead of private space companies such as SpaceX in protecting the safety of their astronauts?
I mean, this is a great question. It's incredibly difficult to answer, but I did put this to space policy expert Wendy Whitman Cobb, and this was her response.
I think the commercial companies are even more incentivized to pay attention to safety than sometimes even NASA, because if they have a mission go wrong and people die, there goes their entire business. It's done. Nobody's ever going to trust them again. So obviously the incentives are different, but I think for NASA, I think Columbia, I think Challenger has taught them to err on the side of caution. And I think the decisions they have made of late with respect to astronaut safety and health give me the confidence that they are paying attention to those things appropriately.
Wendy Whitman Cobb, what a fantastic summary. Yep, commercial company, one big mistake, one bunch of deaths, your company's broke, you're out of business forever.
Interesting. Interesting take. All right. The next question is from Matt, and it's a fantastic one. I love the podcast. I felt so sorry for everyone involved. Your interviews with the engineers were heartbreaking. They were full of wisdom. I agree. I work in the construction industry, and I once attended a safety leadership seminar about the Challenger disaster. The person talking at the seminar said somewhat derisively, the solution that they used to fix the problem with the O-rings on the solid rocket boosters, they just added a third O-ring. In your podcast, the engineer, that's Brian Russell, mentioned that he decided to stay on with Thiokol because he was young and he wanted to be part of the team that fixed the problem. He mentioned feeling proud of the solution they came up with. But I Googled what they did, and it was certainly more than just adding a third O-ring. Carl, what did that re-engineered joint look like on the solid rocket boosters?
They did add another O-ring, but it wasn't just simply, if two is good, three is better. They redesigned the joint, and they added extra features to protect it from joint rotation, so reduce the rotation of the joint and therefore the pressure on the O-ring even less, as well as extra measures to stop gases going there, as well as adding the extra O-ring, as well as heaters. So if it got cold below zero, the O-rings would stay warm and flexible. So, yes, they did add another O-ring, but there was a lot more than just that. One final thought on Challenger. Something I know lots of people ask online about this disaster that we did not cover in detail in the series. What actually happened to the Challenger astronauts, and did they die when the shuttle exploded? Will we give this a go?
And just a warning, this is quite confronting to think about, but I also think it points to the bravery of those astronauts on that day in 1986. And before we even launch into, you know, what did and didn't happen to them, we need to start at the start, because we often hear about the Challenger exploding. The investigation after the disaster revealed that the shuttle itself didn't actually explode.
No. If you look at the timeline, it's 14 seconds from when a plume of gas was seen near the rear or aft attached strut on the right solid booster. Okay, so a plume is seen. Within 1 second, there's a drop of pressure inside the solid booster. Within another 6 seconds, there's a drop of pressure inside the liquid hydrogen tank. A couple of seconds later, the tank is beginning to get burned through the attachment point, and the people on the ground know nothing, and they say, "Challenger, go at throttle up," and they respond, and then the right solid booster pulls away from the strut. Everything separates. One booster goes one way, another booster goes the other way, the liquid hydrogen and oxygen tank goes another way, and the shuttle itself goes a third way. So they're all going in different directions. Now, unfortunately, the Challenger is no longer going pointy in through the atmosphere. It's going at twice the speed of sound, but kind of side on, and it tears itself apart into several chunks. A wing, a main engine, the crew cab, and various other little bits and pieces. And you could see the place where the crew would be exiting the vapor cloud. So it didn't explode, it broke apart from the aerodynamic forces of going sideways at nearly Mach 2.
And based on NASA's findings, the crew was probably still alive at this point. And they know this because each astronaut had a personal air supply for emergencies. And there was evidence that three of them were activated before the crew compartment hit the ocean.
So they were in the shuttle. It went up to about 20 kilometres before it came down. Took a couple of minutes before it hit the ocean. They knew something was going on. They didn't know what. And they still, my God, they're amazing. They had the presence of mind to activate each other's air supplies because the switch was around the back. And the moment they died was when they hit the Atlantic.
That's right. An unsurvivable impact at more than 300 kilometres per hour, 2 minutes and 45 seconds after liftoff. Now, it's worth pointing out that NASA's official report into the fate of the Challenger crew determined that their exact cause of death could not be determined, and that the astronauts possibly, but not certainly, lost consciousness shortly after the breakup of the shuttle. Now, another one. This is a Columbia question. We got a really, really interesting email from a man called Mike Walker. His question is about Columbia, but he starts with an observation about the Challenger investigation. He says, "Hi, folks. I was always led to believe post-Challenger that the brains in the investigation committee discovered the O-ring issue. I had no idea that the Morton Thiokol engineers were aware of the issue pre-launch. To me, that is a clear case of criminal negligence by NASA." So this was an interesting point raised, because a few people came back to me saying, "Oh, great, can't wait to listen to the Challenger podcast. I'm sure you talk about Richard Feynman a lot because, you know, he's responsible for coming up with the theory as to what caused Challenger." And he wasn't really, was he? I mean, he was significant. He played a significant role in the Rogers Commission, but he wasn't necessarily the person with the knowledge from the start.
He was a no-nonsense physicist who said you can't fool nature. So what you see is what you get with your naked eye. He also had won a Nobel Prize, and he was a genius physicist in the sense that he could see questions that you and I could not. So he had a depth of understanding. He did this experiment. He called for a jug of ice-cold water. Mm. And because there was ice in it, therefore the temperature was zero. He then put a small slice of O-ring in it, and then took it out and showed that it became less pliable at low temperatures. That meant that it could let the gases go past under the wrong conditions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He did that.
Interesting. So, and this demonstration was simple, digestible, and it clearly captured the public's imagination. And, you know, 40 years on, people still remember it. But it wasn't actually the discovery of what went wrong. It was a demonstration of what went wrong. And it was the Morton-Thiokol engineers who revealed what had happened to Challenger, and, you know, and they predicted it. Right from the start of the space shuttle program, they had concerns about the performance of the O-ring. Okay, Carl, so Mike continues. Post the Columbia accident, did NASA not consider a post-launch sequence in the case of a serious foam strike that would abort the mission at a suborbital point, allowing the shuttle to jettison the SRBs and use the external tank to power the shuttle engine to a trajectory to enable it to land somewhere? Even a belly landing on water may have been survivable.
They did have some options. The first option was just they'd keep on going until they got to orbit, which doesn't sound like much of a major change, but they call that an abort to orbit, so they're going to orbit. The next one is a transoceanic abort landing, and in several continents on planet Earth, there were really, really, really long airstrips that were designated as places where they could land of the order of several kilometres long, and that was called a transoceanic abort landing. So somehow they get rid of the solid boosters and the liquid tank, the hydrogen and the oxygen, and then glide to somewhere else. Then, getting even less preferable, we're going to abort once around, so go around the Earth and come back in again. Then harder again, the most risky, return to the launch site. Very risky, never performed in the history. Trying to land on water, on one hand, a pilot of a small jet, a single aisle jet, did manage to land on the Hudson River, was it Sully, but that landed at a much lower speed.
Sure.
It had really big wings. It was optimised for flying in the atmosphere, whereas the shuttle was not, and it would have kissed the water at a very high speed, and almost certainly it would break apart and flood.
Right.
There were no really good options except maybe being able to land at a really long airstrip on another continent somewhere.
Sure. Now, Cassandra asks, can you see out the window of the space shuttle? And if so, what can you see?
They did have windows back then. The windows were actually made of thick glass. Nowadays, acrylics and other plastics, which are lighter and stronger, but that was back then. Altogether, they had some 11 windows, 6 windows in the cockpit, and then 2 overhead windows in the flight deck, so the crew could look both ahead and straight up, and then a couple of more windows in the back of the crew module that looked onto the payload bay, so they might use the big arm to lift up something to insert it into orbit, and they could see what they were doing. Certainly, they needed visibility for the last few minutes when they were only doing 800 or 1,000 kilometres an hour and they had good visibility ahead of them. They needed that visibility for landing by hand, but they could not see the area of the wing where the foam landed. There was no way they could inspect the damage from inside the shuttle. Now, we have another question from Adrian in Canberra who says, hi team, I have a question regarding the Columbia space shuttle. Why were the astronauts not sent on a spacewalk to inspect the wing for damage? Fiona?
Okay, so we briefly touched on this in episode 3, our Columbia episode. There is an exhaustive appendix to the Columbia Accident Investigation Board report where basically NASA investigates all of the different scenarios for rescuing the Columbia crew, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. The CABE report does talk about the possibility of a spacewalk to inspect the wing and see if there was damage. Now, spacewalks hadn't been planned for this mission, and they only had the minimum of tools used in spacewalks, or what NASA calls extra vehicular activity, an EVA. They didn't have the cameras they usually used in spacewalks either, or the jetpacks they could use to make it back to the shuttle in an emergency if they were separated from the craft. So, you know, there was a lot of kind of missing elements, but the report judged that a spacewalk was possible, in the report terms, moderately difficult. The tricky bit is, even after you do the spacewalk, you find the damage, then what? They could have tried to send up the Atlantis shuttle, but they're risking another crew and vehicle. And the Columbia crew have to survive with enough food, water, and oxygen while they wait for Atlantis to arrive. So, yes, spacewalk was possible, but possibly not helpful in saving the crew's life. And at this point, they still weren't sure that they had any damage at all. They didn't believe that foam strikes could cause any damage. And just FYI, if you're a keen bean, you can read the whole report. It's incredibly comprehensive.
Okay, now here's another one for you. Merlin asks, what happened to Ian Clark?
Just a reminder, Ian is the son of John and Laurel Clark. And Laurel Clark was, of course, one of the astronauts on board Columbia who was killed on re-entry. Now, Ian was 8 years old when his mum died in that disaster. Now, I didn't actually speak to Ian for this series, but from speaking to his dad, John, Ian's doing very well. And he actually has a daughter who is also named Laurel. And she's 9 years old now, roughly the same age that Ian was when his mum died. And they all live together with John.
Oh, isn't that nice that we humans have families and we have continuity?
Mm.
Okay, following along, there's a couple of really good questions here, Fee, about culture and risk, and I'll read it out. Hi, Fiona and Carl. Listening to the Challenger Legacy, I can't help but think of General Motors in the US. Okay, all right, so they were once the biggest auto company in the world. They had a lot of quality control issues in the 1970s and 1980s, and then they collaborated with a Japanese company, Toyota, to try to improve the production line problems. And one interesting thing was they picked up a bit of philosophy from Toyota where a single worker could stop the entire production line, half a kilometre long, at any point if they saw an issue with quality control. I'm curious as to why NASA didn't look to other organisational problems that had already occurred outside their industry to see what solutions might exist. And finishes off with, that's a long bow to draw, but I wonder how you think this could have aligned in finding organisational solutions for NASA. And that email's from Andrew, who himself is a former Toyota employee here in Australia. What do you reckon, Fee?
Interestingly, while I was researching for this series, I came across a NASA training document from 2014 called The Cost of Silence. And that makes reference to the 2012 Costa Concordia disaster, which of course was when the luxury cruise ship capsized and sunk off the coast of Italy, killing 32 people. And Costa Concordia is used as an example of normalization of deviance because the ship's captain consciously deviated from the approved course. And this happened more than once. That reference is evidence that there was some outward reflection from NASA.
Thanks, Fee. And as a side note, senior producer on this series, James Bullen, actually did a deep dive on normalisation of deviance for the ABC's psychology podcast, the one called All in the Mind. So just look for the episode called Can Normalisation of Deviance Help to Explain a Catastrophe? And you'll find it on ABC Listen.
Now, here's a related question that comes from Joe. Hi, Fiona and Carl. Thanks for your in-depth podcast on the Challenger disaster. Where do you feel the NASA culture of decision-making and collaborative decision-making is today? Now, this is an extremely timely question. Carl, did you see the report that came out late last week about Starliner?
No, tell me about it.
You'll probably remember back in 2024 when two astronauts got stranded on the International Space Station for months. Since then, an investigation into what went wrong during and after the mission to test that Boeing Starliner spacecraft was conducted, and the findings that were released last week were not good. NASA actually designated the incident as a Type A mishap, which is the same categorization applied to Challenger and Columbia. This is how NASA's current administrator, Jared Isaacman, responded to this report. And I was particularly interested in what he had to say about NASA's culture.
Starliner has design and engineering deficiencies that must be corrected. But the most troubling failure revealed by this investigation is not hardware. It's decision-making and leadership that if left unchecked, could create a culture incompatible with human spaceflight.
Wow, a culture incompatible with human spaceflight. What's he saying, Fee?
According to a report, some of the personnel stated that astronaut safety was not as central as it should have been. When we talk about Challenger, we're having the exact same conversation. So it's really, really interesting to hear those words in 2026.
Well, the American space program for space exploration and discovery is especially married to politics.
Mm.
And certainly this politician will want a factory to make that part for this aerospace in their constituency and so on. But then they've got to have that commitment to long-term funding at a regular rate, not suddenly a vast influx deluge followed by nothing and everybody gets fired and the corporate knowledge gets lost. So when you get these changes and you don't get this long-term consistency, we get people changing, the culture changing, and the bottom line is that safety suddenly is not the main priority anymore.
All right, now, Carl, let's finish with a few questions about the Artemis moon missions, which we talked about in episode 5. With NASA now looking to April 1st as the earliest possible launch date for Artemis 2, Catherine asks, will we lose contact with the Artemis craft as it goes around the moon?
Okay, so firstly, the far side of the moon is a black zone with no communication. Secondly, there's a big change. We're no longer using radio. We're using lasers. And the advantage of the lasers is that the data rate is so much higher. It's still traveling at the speed of light, but the data rate is so much higher and you get a higher signal to noise, so the signal is cleaner. But you've then got to have fancier electronics to aim the laser directly at the receiver, vice versa in both directions. And so when Artemis does go on the far side of the moon, we'll lose contact for around 40-ish minutes.
Okay.
Now, Greg's asking, we know with the Artemis, you know, it's going to be launching now and now and now at certain times. What determines a launch window in the first place?
Okay. So this is a question that I asked Peter King, the correspondent for CBS News Radio, and he had a great explanation.
So many of the launches to the space station, for example, were at night, and people would say, well, geez, you know, that's too late for me to stay up and go out and watch it. Why can't they do it during the day? The reason being, NASA wants Orion to get to the moon using a minimum amount of maneuvering fuel. So they basically set up the launch windows when the moon is at the most favorable position for that to happen. They don't want to run out of gas on the way because they need it on the way home for mid-course corrections, that kind of thing. And if they were going into orbit, they would need the propulsion to get out of orbit, and they can't use up all their gas.
So there you go. And this is another Artemis question. Anna has asked, can you explain how Orion actually gets to the moon? Does it fly direct or does it go into orbit around the Earth first?
It goes around the Earth first. So first it goes into something a bit above low Earth orbit, and then they do what's called a multi-phase trajectory, where they'll shove themselves into a slightly different orbit that optimizes them getting towards the moon, and then, fancy phrase, translunar injection. So they fire the rockets at exactly the right time for exactly the right amount of time to head towards the moon, and then they do a figure eight around the moon, and they're doing what they call a slingshot maneuver. So we first started using this in the Voyager program back in the 1970s, where we found we could pick up a few extra kilometers per second of velocity for free from orbiting in a particular trajectory past a planet. And so hey, if all you need is a bit of mathematics to get some free velocity, do it. We call this the slingshot effect. And so then they'll fly around the moon. It's then going to loop around and then start heading back to Earth again.
Okay. And here's another one on the mission mechanics. Peter asks, somebody mentioned that Orion will re-enter Earth's atmosphere much faster than the Apollo capsules did. Why is this?
Right, okay. It will be faster than the Apollo capsules. The fastest Apollo capsule was Apollo 10. It came in at around 39,900. This is going to come in 100 kilometres an hour faster. Not 1,000, 100. So instead of 39,900, it'll be 40,000. And the reason for that is it's had to escape from the moon's gravity, had to burn a bit of fuel, so it's going to keep on coming into the Earth's atmosphere at similar speeds to the Apollo's, around 11 kilometres per second. So a little bit faster, but only barely.
Sure.
Okay, Fee, sorry to do this. Here's a curly one from Tori, and she writes, what are the emissions likely to be for the Artemis II mission? More broadly, she goes on, are emissions quantified in space exploration?
So, generally speaking, there hasn't been a lot of research into the impact of space travel emissions on the atmosphere until recently because rocket launches were infrequent, but that is, of course, changing. From what we were able to find in terms of the space shuttle launches, general emissions weren't specified. The environmental impact of space exploration has been considered in a variety of ways. You know, that's including space junk. Definitely, it would be the case that launching spacecraft causes all sorts of harmful emissions, the burning of rocket propellants, that kind of thing. But there are a handful of studies on this and we can link to them in the show notes. But Carl, this is actually something that we've chatted about in the studio, just by the by, around the environmental impact of spaceflight. What are your thoughts?
We're heading towards a little bit of a mess with regard to the stratosphere. When the rockets go up, as you pointed out, they burn a fuel, hydrogen and oxygen, or with methane, something like that, or even aluminium. And that leaves emissions in the stratosphere. And at the moment, we've got 10,000 spacecraft in orbit. Soon we're going to be getting, by soon I mean 2030, we're going to have 50,000. They'll have a life of 5 years, the Starlinks and the like. And so there'll be 10,000 of them coming each year back in the atmosphere. That's over 30 a day. So wow. There will be problems. We need to keep an eye out for it, and hopefully our scientific endeavours will help us avoid something bad.
Another thing worth considering. So, Carl, here's another big question from Teresa. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So, Teresa says, hello, Fiona and Dr. Carl. Excellent series. Thank you very much. My question is why? Why are we traveling to space in the first place? What are the benefits to humanity, life on Earth? I'm curious.
Okay, practical benefits. Have you ever used GPS? Well, the point is that GPS is space stuff, and it gets you where you want to go. So the satellite technology also involves weather forecasting. Mate, farmers don't plan stuff without getting weather forecasts. Climate monitoring, telecommunications, stuff bounces around there. Remote sensing with regard to greenhouse warming, disaster response. So with certain modern smartphones, if you're way out of town and you fall over and you break your leg, you hit the button and then that alerts a satellite to come and get you. Long-term survival. We have to start thinking about asteroids wiping out society as well as other long-term survival things based on the or related to the technological and industrial spin-offs. And finally, curiosity. Understanding our origins of the universe, that flows on to other useful things. And of course, research on microgravity and medicine. The benefits financially outweigh the cost. I think I have no proof. I must get proof on that. Thank you for giving me more homework, Dr. Teresa.
One follow-up on that. Is human exploration critical in that kind of work?
I have an irrational thought on this. With no proof whatsoever and no science, I reckon that space is our destiny. We will learn how to survive in space. We will learn how to get rockets that give us 1G. space is our destiny. We need to get humans in space because we discover other things that then relate back to humans over and above what we can do with robots.
Okay,
Fee, here's a wonderful question from Marilyn. And she asks, and I quote, "What is the experience of travelling to space like? And did any of the people you spoke to share any amazing memories?"
Thank you, Marilyn. Great question. We spend a lot of time talking about launches in this series, but not from the perspective of the astronaut. And so we did put this question to a retired NASA astronaut. His name's Tony Antonelli.
It looks like the space shuttle just gracefully lifts up off the launch pad, climbs up, clears the tower, 8 seconds. We roll over upside down. We go to space mostly upside down. It feels nothing like that. It feels like you're sitting on top of a rocket, right? I think that's why they use that phrase. The solids are so, so powerful. You leap off of the launch pad. You know instantly when the solids light, you're not staying here. You're not yet sure where you're going or how many pieces you're going to be in when you get there, right? But you're not staying here. And so if you watch a space shuttle launch video again, when the space shuttle clears the launch tower, she's already going 80 miles an hour and accelerating. So incredible sense of power coming off the pad. And then you ride the solids for just over 2 minutes. They make some noise and shake you a little bit. After 2 minutes, the solids come off. You're above all the thick air, so completely smooth, completely quiet. The liquid engines are far enough back you don't hear them from the flight deck. And then you're still getting pushed back in your seat, like you're accelerating, and you're already going faster than you've ever gone in your life. Doesn't matter what airplane you flew before you got to this point, right? Now you're going fast. You ride the liquid engines for about another 6.5 minutes, and you think, wow, I'm going faster than I've ever gone in my life, and you're still accelerating. A few seconds later, you're like, huh, now I'm going faster than I was a few seconds ago when I was going pretty fast. This thought every few seconds rolls through your head until you get going fast enough for orbital speed, which I think is kind of hard to wrap your mind around, right? So 17,500 miles an hour. I drive a pickup truck and my speedometer doesn't even go to 1,000. So I'm like, I don't even know what 17 is. All the way around the planet in an hour and a half. Next time you take a trip that's an hour and a half long, imagine you just saw everything, everybody, like people you like, people you haven't met yet, like that's it. And the planet seems really small when you can make a trip around it in an hour and a half. And then 25 times the speed of sound, so.
Wow, I am so insanely jealous.
And that's just the launch.
Wow. And then being able to be in orbit, and then every now and then you're looking down and you can say, oh, that's Australia, and you look away for a minute. Oh, hang on, where's Australia? Oh, it's gone. Oh, sorry, that's Hawaii, right? Okay. And then at night they see the auroras and they see storm clouds from above.
Mm.
Oh, man, I wish I could see that.
Yeah. Now, to wrap up, I got this question through from Fred, and I think it's a really good one. Why are we so alarmed at the two space shuttle failures? Is it the spectacular public nature of the fatalities, the failure of the project and dent in NASA's credibility and loss of national pride, or the simple root causes you have investigated? Someone eaten by a shark makes headlines. Someone killed on the road is a statistic. Spaceflight is inherently risky. Should we be surprised if there is an Artemis failure? There was only one unmanned test launch after all. It seems to be a do or die situation, certainly for NASA. Thank you and best regards, Fred.
Wow, that was very insightful of them to say, it seems to be a do or die situation.
Mm.
If they fail, immediately everybody will wash their hands of NASA and blame somebody else. If they succeed, everybody will take credit. And the thing is, it is inherently risky. It's easy to get into space. You can see that from the size of the little rockets that Virgin and Blue Origin use to pop people up and then bring them down again. It's easy to get into space. It's hard to stay there. You need to burn a lot of fuel. And That is a huge amount of energy consumed in just 7 minutes. If you've got all that energy concentrated, bad things sometimes do happen. Nothing made by humans can be perfect. So I think he's right that it is inherently risky. And then he asked the philosophical question of, okay, so somebody died in a motor vehicle collision. Why don't you expend as much grief on them? I think we're kind of irrational. I just have to go with it. What do you reckon, Dr. Fee?
So it's interesting. Someone we spoke to, Adam Higginbotham, speaking about the Challenger disaster, he says, you know, there was before Challenger and after Challenger, and it that disaster changed us, and we were kind of naive before it happened. And it was so shocking, and particularly shocking because Krista McCall of the civilian teacher was on board. But then when Columbia happened, it didn't rock us nearly as much because we'd experienced Challenger. And so maybe Challenger was the most shocking. I don't know. I thought that was an interesting example. But yeah, the comparisons that Fred raises, if there's a fatal airline crash, it's shocking, but we're not shocked to the core because we do know that there are inherent risks in air flight. But yes, space flight feels more shocking, even though, you know, the risks are far greater.
Well, I think one way to reduce the risks and the pollution is to build a ladder to space. Go up to a satellite 36,000 kilometres out from the Earth above the equator, extrude a heavy lump of rock one side, on the other side extrude some carbon nanofibre. We haven't quite got it strong enough yet. We will, when it hits the ground at the equator, bolt it down, and we get into space by going in an elevator.
Sounds like a Dr. Seuss book.
Love it. I think they used that in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Well, thank you for sending through all your wonderful questions. And for, of course, listening to the Challenger Legacy series. My name's Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl. And Fiona, thank you so much for all your hard work in finding all this information and the interviews. Man, you do so much work.
Thanks, Carl. It's been a real honour to work on this series.
Mate, I've learned so much. Thank you, Dr. Fee. And thank you, audience, for coming along the journey with us.
The show's senior producer is James Bullen, and our sound engineer is Emrys Cronin. Now, if you've enjoyed the Challenger Legacy series, please remember to tell your friends and leave us a review. It all helps people find us. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.